You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Monocle 24 in London with me, Ted Kravitz. Coming up on the programme, 2 years in prison for the three members of Russian protest group Pussy Riot, but how will the jail terms for the three women be seen by Russians in the street and the watching world?
What happened? What these girls really did? Did they broke something? No. They just danced and they just made a video about this. So, okay, they have their own political position. They are against Putin, they are against President of Russia. They didn't do anything harmful.
He was the BBC's Washington correspondent for much of the Bush and Clinton presidencies. Gavin Esler talks about how the really great world leaders handle being the focus of media attention 24 hours a day.
I mean, nobody would have seriously asked Margaret Thatcher about her children or personal questions in the way that politicians now have to deal with. And I feel slightly sorry for them. But I also feel that they should just stand up and say, I'm sorry, I'm here as Foreign Secretary or Chancellor of the Exchequer or Prime Minister. Get lost.
Plus, our man in Addis Ababa reports on the fantastically meticulous process that is drawing Ethiopia's lottery winners. And I'll be joined by Santiago Tanditi to review this month's edits section of Monocle magazine. Santiago, welcome. What stories will you be looking at today?
Well, we'll talk about a couple of recipes that the Swiss Army's head chef shared with us in, as you said, this month's edit section.
Okay, sounds good. All that coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. But first on the programme, let's catch up on the latest world news with Jonathan Wheatley.
A judge has today sentenced three members of the Russian feminist anti-Putin punk band Pussy Riot to 2 years in jail for staging a protest against the president in a church, an act the judge called blasphemous. Meanwhile, demonstrators all over the world, particularly in Paris, Brussels, Kiev and Moscow, have gathered today. Supporters like the head of Amnesty International in Belgium, Philippe Ensmans, said the verdict put President Vladimir Putin's tolerance of dissent on trial.
It's a pity for the freedom of expression. It's a pity, of course, for these three women who didn't who just expressed their own opinion without calling for hate or you know, calling for crimes or whatever. It's really something against international standards regarding freedom of expression. It's a bad sign for Russia. It's a bad sign about the future of this country, which is obviously not trusting its own civil society.
The opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, has also condemned the verdict, saying it was a show of defiance from Putin. The lawyers for Pussy Riot agreed, saying their defendant's jail sentence had already been decided by the Russian president. Two US soldiers in Afghanistan have been shot dead by policemen in the western province of Farah today, according to the chief NATO force spokesman, Brigadier General Gunter Katz.
This morning, in Farah province, a member of the Afghan local police shot two American soldiers, killed them, and the shooter has been killed as well. The investigation is still ongoing and we have no findings yet in terms of what the reason for this insider threat incident was.
The killing by police of 34 striking platinum miners in the bloodiest security operation since the end of white rule cut to the quick of South Africa's psyche today, with people and the media questioning its post-apartheid soul. The Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union president Joseph Mathunwa told a news conference in Johannesburg that police objectivity at the Lonmin mine needed to be questioned.
The writings are on the wall. I thought the history that I read about Sharpeville massacre was a history. I never thought that in 2012 we will experience the same massacre under the democratic elected government by ourselves. This is a shame.
France's Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, completing a visit to Lebanon, has said today that Beirut should do more to help Syrian refugees and that the movement of defections of high-level Syrian officials was bound to rise. Meanwhile, Syrian refugees, like Mahmoud, have expressed discontent with Fabius's visit and asking for more concrete measures to thwart further killings on civilians in Syria.
That we have listened and heard a lot of rumors. What else? We are waiting for something on the land. We wait for something for the Syrian people inside to stop killing, to stop shelling, to help the people inside Syria. That's what we need and want. Not just to promise us and to do something and then nothing.
And finally, the owner of a Brooklyn bar is suing New York City after police put the bar's entire stock of alcohol down the drain in a liquor license dispute. David Kelleran claimed in his lawsuit that the police's prohibition-style tactics violated state law and trampled on his rights. And in any case, he believed the police had gone to the wrong address. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And Jonathan will be back with the news headlines at the bottom of the hour. It's 21:06 in Moscow, 18:06 here in London, and 13:06 in New York. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. Now, as we've been hearing in the news, three members of Russian punk collective Pussy Riot have been jailed for 2 years after staging an anti-Vladimir Putin protest in a Moscow cathedral. Judge Marina Sirova convicted the women of hooliganism motivated by religious hatred, saying that Maria Alokhina, Nadezhda Tolokonikova and Yekaterina Samutsevich had crudely undermined social order. The women say the protest back in February had been directed at the Russian Orthodox Church leaders' support for Mr. Putin. Well, Monocle 24's news editor Tom Edwards joins me in the studio. Tom, I think it's fair to say that a guilty verdict had been expected, but there'd been plenty of discussion about the length of the sentence. People have been saying that 3 years, 2 years. How do you think the two-year sentence will actually be received?
I think people will... Basically, I think that the people had their viewpoints before the sentencing, they're not going to change. I think the skeptics who feel these protesters, as they would regard them, are being made an example of, will still maintain that view, whilst the people who believed that the judge was in a position where, you know, they had to sort of isolate these people from public life will feel vindicated and that a two-year sentence is adequate. I've been watching Russia Today and looking at other sort of media outlets to see how they've responded to it. It's been very interesting how certainly the English language press out of Russia has really attempted today to reflect the fact that this is a very divisive issue and that there are these two clear and distinct camps on this matter. So whilst they are happy to sort of follow the words of the judge very closely, particularly this idea that... as I said before, they needed to be isolated from the public in order to reform them, which is kind of quite sort of old-fashioned, almost like Soviet language. At the same time, they're eager to get dissenting bloggers on the screen. We've also heard from the British MP Kerry McCarthy, who visited Moscow last week during the trial, the build-up to this verdict. So they're trying to reflect the fact that the world's eyes are on this and that it's a very divisive issue. And I think that... for the most part, the English language broadcasters have done a reasonably good job with that.
Well, it's interesting in its timing, isn't it? Because here we are towards the middle, edging towards the end of 2012. And Russia's had its many show trials, if we're going to call it that, throughout the years. But usually they've been sort of oligarchs. You know, Mikhail Khodorkovsky comes to mind. But this is the one that's really captured the imagination, especially in a time that we're living in, you know, with instant comment of Twitter and instant, as you say, the bloggers giving their instant instant reaction, and that could be actually very powerful in this case.
Well, absolutely, and I think one thing that really struck me about this was how much people sort of reading into this case and its implications, not just for free speech within Russia, and not just about how dissenting voices are treated by the Putin administration, but also in the sense of Russia is still... there's still huge scope for inward investment. There's still lots of business opportunities there. There was an interesting piece in the Financial Times that went up as this result verdict was announced today, talking about the response of companies. And in this piece by Stefan Wagstiel in the FT, he explains that even if companies feel safe operating in Russia, they may not feel comfortable. Talking about the unpredictable Russian legal environment and how foreign executives... won't want to sing punk songs in the cathedral, but will they really want to work in a country where people who do so go to jail? And I think that's really interesting to look at once at the free speech, what kind of tolerance there is, how dissent is viewed from the Kremlin, what Putin's personal reaction is to these kind of challenges, but also to consider those implications. You know, will there be more of a direct price for Russia to pay when we have this kind of unpredictable legal landscape?
I mean, the media response has been, it's been a gift to a lot of the websites and indeed the newspapers, given that the three defendants here are all under 30. They're all women. And the pictures of Nadezhda, Yekaterina and Maria are all over the internet and will be, no doubt, over some of the front pages. And an interesting trio they make, too.
Absolutely. It's certainly a gift, as you say, I think, for news-hungry editorial teams during the quiet month of August. One thing on that media coverage that has struck me today is, particularly from actually Western media outlets, including in the United States, is how wary they've been about even describing this group by their name. I mean, this is a slightly kind of flippant side of this story, but I think it's interesting how sensitive they are. In the United States, the Washington Post, for example, refrained from using the group's name, calling them instead Russian punk rockers. The New York Times, similarly, were cagey about it. And on NBC's Today show, they really set the tone for the US media with their morning presenter, Michelle Kosinski, this morning saying, describing them as the punk rock girl band whose name we can't say on morning television.
Can they not?
Which I just think is a fascinating insight into these, exactly how conservative with a small C some American broadcasters certainly can be at times.
Yeah, you do wonder how they deal with the cues of pieces involving cute little cats, don't you? But anyway, that's
absolutely
probably a different matter. There have been 60 arrests outside the court this afternoon and going into this evening in Moscow. It's not difficult to imagine this igniting the old anti-Putin protests, is it? Although they might consider that this is what Putin is trying to do with people who lodge dissent against him.
Absolutely. I mean, I was really struck by the images of the former world chess champion, Garry Kasparov, who's, again, a well-known dissenting voice, but not exactly a sort of dangerous radical by any stretch, though he is an opponent of Putin's. He was bundled unceremoniously onto this bus that the police had driven in to sort of take away these protesters. And as he sort of clung to the door in resistance, demanded to know, you know, what he was being arrested for. And I think if you shift from the media landscape to the political landscape, there is definitely a sense that this will certainly revitalise those dissenting groups and provide more of a direct challenge to Putin and his sort of acolytes. And that possibly this could be the beginning of a real show of strong resistance to his intolerance of free speech.
And that's particularly fascinating because Kasparov's like David Beckham in Russia, the chess champion.
Massive. There couldn't be a more explicit show from Putin and from the police that, you know, nobody is above the law and that what they are all about is making a statement of their intolerance. And as you say, a folk hero like Kasparov isn't safe, then it makes you wonder who is.
OK, well, I'm sure we'll be following all the fallout from that story as we go in throughout the weeks to come. Thanks very much, Tom. That's Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards. And we'll be back in a moment to hear from BBC correspondent Gavin Esler on how business and political leaders get to and then stay at the top of their games.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On this week's episode of Section D, we hear some of the extraordinary sounds and stories of the people who make things in East London, courtesy of designer Dominic Wilcox, who's recorded an LP compilation. That's a vinyl cutter in Hackney. We'll also hear from the people behind this. That's the Whitechapel Bell Foundry, Britain's oldest manufacturer. Elsewhere in this week's episode, we'll hear about the favourite things of Gonzalo Fonseca, the charismatic founder of Madrid leather goods brand Steve Mono. And we'll take a tour around Berlin's store Color and hear how the owners are staying ahead of the pack on their retail patch.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
London, Monocle 24.
18.15 here in London, 10.15 a.m. in Seattle. This is Midori House. Now, for 35 years, Gavin Esler has been asking the questions of some of the world's most intriguing figures, from presidents to prime ministers, business tycoons to media moguls and pop stars. And while their answers have varied, a common theme he's found has emerged, that leaders are masters of the art of the story. Little nuggets to drop into the mind of the listener. What form these stories take are examined and described in Esler's new book, entitled Lessons from the Top. And earlier, Gavin came into Midori House to talk to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Steve started by asking what the BBC had been like as an organisation when Gavin first started working there.
I'm not sure I know. I remember what it was like as an organisation. You know, it was back in the last millennium, in the Stone Age. But what I do remember was there was so much less of it. In other words, there were three TV channels, and I can't remember how many radio channels. But and now there's so much more, and so much more is available, and so much has been written about how the internet and so on has changed the way we consume the media, which is true. People tend to be talking about the form of it. You know, you go on your laptop, or I was reading some news stories on my mobile phone before I came in here, which is all fantastic, but it changes the content as well. So the storytelling changes. So there's so much more of it. It's so much quicker. And we have become, I think, since the end of the Cold War, a confessional culture where we're used to listening to fairly dreary celebrities talk about their sex lives and making films about their sex lives and their families and so on, in a way which would have been prurient 30 years ago. And it's infected politics. I mean, nobody would have seriously asked Margaret Thatcher about her children or personal questions in the way that politicians now have to deal with. And I feel slightly sorry for them. But I also feel that they should just stand up and say, I'm sorry, I'm here as Foreign Secretary or Chancellor of the Exchequer or Prime Minister. Get lost.
And do you think, I mean, you mentioned the Cold War. I mean, do you think there was something specific about that moment where things changed? Or is it just it's gradually changed over the last 20 or so years?
I think there was a turning point, but it was a coincidence of things. I talk quite a lot about how Hello Magazine has become this phenomenon from being something which was set up in fascist Spain in the 1940s, and it's now a worldwide phenomenon. And that kind of journalism has spread to beyond the celebrity culture that it started with. And also because the Cold War was a period where we thought we've really been at war in Europe, at least since 1914 to 1989, till the Berlin Wall came down. I mean, there were a few pauses and it wasn't always a hot war, but we were on the edge of conflict. And therefore, we could again give our leaders a very hard time, but we didn't go too much into their personal lives. And this confessional culture, which built up through the 90s, of which why Clinton, to me, is such an important figure, is he was the first post-Cold War president. And he was then fair game for the adultery allegations and all kinds of other things. He certainly wasn't the first American president to sleep with somebody that he wasn't married to. And we know that, but we only found out about the others much later.
And do you think there's also issues over, I mean, you say that before when you started, there are three TV channels, there are less outlets. Now there are more outlets, but there appear to be less journalists.
Well, I think there may be the same number of journalists, but they're doing so much more because they're expected to do radio, TV, internet, blogs, podcasts, webcasts, all sorts of things. So there's so much more, and I think journalists are spread more thinly. And also, you know, Wikipedia culture always strikes me as very strange. When I go and talk to groups of young aspiring journalists and ask them how they research things, and they talk about going on the net, and I say, but when you look at the sources for so much stuff in Wikipedia, there's a kind of phony academics going on because they source things to newspapers that you know are not reliable. And that's their source. And they do it as if they're sourcing it to, you know, the word of somebody who is actually there.
Because they've got that little sort of footnote annotation mark there that looks like a proper professional footnote.
It absolutely looks like a professional footnote. And then you see it's to a paper that you wouldn't, newspaper that you wouldn't put at the bottom of your budgie's cage. So I find that extraordinary. So I get people quote things back to me that they've read on Wikipedia, and you think, where do you get this stuff? Well, they get it from other people who quote it from other people who don't know what they're talking about. So the edges, we have this culture where any old nonsense is possible and believable, and you can't get rid of it. You can never correct this stuff. On the other hand, the good news about that is there's a kind of flight to quality, so that programs like Newsnight that I work on and some newspapers, Monocle and others, people go to those sources because they're reliable and they trust them. And that's why trust is so precious, it seems to me.
And just finally, I mean, are you generally optimistic about the state of the media when we look ahead to the next decade? That, okay, there might be some things around the edges which we don't like, and there may be certain things like the celebrity confessionals, which there are too many of, but on the whole, there is enough quality and there's enough investment and there's still enough great reporting.
I think there's, I'm optimistic about some things. I'm optimistic that there will always be a demand from readers and viewers and listeners for the best. There will always be a demand for stuff which is reliable. The Economist sales, for instance, the past 20 years have gone up. BBC is doing very well. And other places where you think it's reliable, that's great. The bad news is, I think newspapers, I mean, the really big story about newspapers in our country is they don't make any money. And there's an argument about standards and some of the illegal activities of some people. But the real question is, how do you make money out of newspapers in the future when reporting, proper reporting, is quite expensive? Sitting reading tweets and turning a celebrity nonsense into a story, that's not expensive.
And that was Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield asking the questions of Gavin Esler there. And you can hear more of this interview on Sunday's Monocle Weekly. That's this coming Sunday, midday UK time. 22 minutes past the hour. We'll be delving into the alleys of old Marseille in a moment. But first, a track from Parisian songstress Emily Loiseau. This is La Femme à Barbe.
Après-demain, j'irai en enfer. Oh, quoi de quoi, quoi de quoi, quoi faire. Je l'aime pas ton sourire de cloche. Et je t'éclate très bien ta caboche. Après-demain, je vais en enfer. Oh, quoi de quoi, quoi de quoi, quoi faire. Je suis piqué comme des cloches. Je t'aurais mieux fait d'avoir un hamster. Oh, quoi de quoi, quoi faire. Tu les tapes, tes jolis petits mioches. Parce qu'hier, ils t'ont fait les poches. C'est sur eux qu'ils te passent les nerfs.
Intriguing. That was Emily Loiseau and La Femme à Barbe. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, Marseille is a city embracing the future while striving to keep its celebrated multicultural personality completely intact. We'll discover the beating heart of Marseille. Monocle Films visits three hoteliers whose establishments reflect the evolution of this heady Mediterranean city. Au Vieux Panier, Le Petit Nice and Hotel Le Corbusier. In a moment, I'll be joined by the film's producer, Gillian Tobias, but first, let's hear a clip.
Marseille is an oyster with plenty of grit. The breezy, brawny port city on France's southern coast has ancient Phoenician origins and a heady modern mix of cultures. Since 600 BC, it has served as a jumping-off point for immigrants, a haven for seafarers, smugglers and commanders. Marseille has been a refuge for Europeans fleeing fascism en route to Casablanca and a location for a genre of gritty gangster films. Now, cranes lurch and swivel in and around its ancient fortifications. There is a multi-billion euro regeneration in the works. Marseille is limbering up for a stint as European capital of culture in 2013. The facelift is unlikely to alter the character of its citizens. Melting pot is a term somewhat overused by urban demographers, but in Marseille, it's sizzling.
A rather beautiful narration by Sophie Grove there on the hotels of the well, it's Marseille seen through the eyes of some of its greatest hoteliers. Tell us about it, Gillian.
Well, probably not the greatest, but the most interesting. I mean, what we always like to do with Monocle Films is not duplicate the article, but complement in a different way. And Sophie went down to Marseille and looked at the city and its regeneration, its problems, its vices, and the potential for the future. We decided what better way to show the evolution of a city, but through three different hotels, and she happened to discover three ones that were completely different from each other, and they each had great stories to tell, but reflect, you know, that beating heart that we talk about.
Well, indeed, and it is a fascinating city, isn't it, Marseille? Because it has, you know, on the face of it, it's on the Côte d'Azur, it's got all this beautiful beaches and blue sky and sand and everything, but it does have these issues and a very, well, we talked earlier on about Moscow, you know, a city ready to ignite. It's had its issues before.
Well, if you think of any port city, you're always going to have vices. And I mean, you mentioned Marseille and everyone thinks of French Connection. They think of all the films that have always shot mafia scenes there. And that's, you know, that was its reality and to a certain extent still is. But when you're there and you see this beautiful Belle Epoque architecture and this gorgeous Mediterranean colors, you wonder why it ever got that bad. And now, partly because it's in 2013, it's going to be City of Culture. But they're this huge regeneration, and I think it's going to make it one of the most exciting cities in that region.
Now, you say you managed to shoot it and tell the stories through the eyes of people who worked in these hotels. Who were these people? Were they old innkeepers, or were they, and what kind of establishments were we talking about?
Well, as I say, all completely different. But there were ones that Sophie felt really were passionate about the city. Like, it was in their veins. Marseille and the whole Provençal world was in their veins. So the first one was Au Vieux Panier, and that's in the very, very old quartier, right behind the old port. And it was where the mafia used to run and hide and shoot out. And this hotel, it's a small B&B, but it's almost more like a gallery. And the hotelier curates every year each room by a different artist. Mm. And you live in a work of art. And it's, again, it's, you know, it's almost more like being in your own house, being in a gallery. There's a wonderful feel to it. And what's interesting with her is this area, Le Vieux Panier, is now being filled with artist studios and galleries. So it reflects that whole vibe of that area, which is kind of a bit like a Montmartre. And the hotel completely reflects that, using some of Marseille's greatest artists, but not just from Marseille.
Yeah, well, that's amazing, certainly as far as Au Vieux Panier goes. Le Petit Nice is quite different, though.
Le Petit Nice is very different. It is a little tiny gem, hugging the cliffs, looking out over the turquoise waters, with the only three-star Michelin restaurant there. Very quiet luxury. And it really is a story of a family business that's kept a very, very small hotel where people return to. But very importantly, they also return for the food, because the food is exceptional. And the owner is also the chef and really embraces the sea. Like, he's passionate about the sea and he's passionate about the fish. And they work with 85 different fish, depending on the year. And it really is a story about why restaurants are good when they do what is on their doorstep naturally and beautifully.
Sounds wonderful. And what kind of stories did you get coming out from the third hotel?
To qualify this. This is probably one of the most interesting, but maybe a sort of warning on the packet. It was a little bit like Fawlty Towers, but it was the Hotel Le Corbusier, which, amazingly, there is a hotel in the Cité Radieuse that was the apartment building built by Le Corbusier between 1947 and 1952. So most of it is apartment buildings, which were an example of modern living. And there was the third floor were shops and a hotel. And this hotel still exists. And two hoteliers bought the hotel, you know, hardly changed it at all. And you can still feel that whole Corbusier vibe. Amazing if you're an architect lover or an architect student, a must.
No, sounds fantastic. And like all your films, they're available on monocle.com and also subscribers, the subscriber area as well.
Well, basically what we always wanted to do is make sure they're available to absolutely everyone. You don't have to be a subscriber. You just go to the programs menu and there they are. Or you can download them by iTunes, but they're just out there for everyone to enjoy.
Great. Monocle.com, the place to go to see more of that. And when have you edited it yet?
Yes, it was up. It went up today. It's premiered today. That's why we're drum rolling it. So it had its premiere.
Man, you edit fast. I'm much slower than that. Good stuff. Okay, make sure you catch that as soon as you can. So Gillian DeBias there with us in the studio. We're at the bottom of the hour and we'll be back with the news headlines in just a second.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать в Monocle 24.
Это Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of Midori House, we'll be talking to Monocle's edit section editor Santiago Tarditi about this month's magazine, and we'll be finding out the symbolism that suffuses Ethiopia's national lottery.
It's very charming, goes back to the 50s, I suppose. It's a white chicken that bears a kind of a big jar, and this jar is filled with money. Or maybe it's a lucky goose. You cannot see, it's just handmade, the symbol. It's hard to be, I would call it a chicken, but maybe it's a goose.
A big white chicken there. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. A judge has today sentenced three members of the Russian feminist anti-Putin punk band Pussy Riot to 2 years in jail for staging a protest against the president in a church, an act the judge called blasphemous. The opposition leader Alexei Navalny has condemned the verdict, saying it was a show of defiance from Putin. The lawyers for Pussy Riot agreed, saying their defendant's jail sentence had already been decided by the Russian president. Two US soldiers in Afghanistan have been shot dead by policemen in the western province of Farah today, according to the chief NATO force spokesman, Brigadier General Gunter Katz. The killing by police of 34 striking platinum miners in the bloodiest security operation since the end of white rule cut to the quick of South Africa's psyche today, with people and the media questioning its post-apartheid soul. The Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union president told a news conference in Johannesburg that police objectivity at the Lonmin mine needs to be questioned. And France's Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius has completed a visit to Lebanon and has said today that Beirut should do more to help Syrian refugees and that the movement of defections of high-level Syrian officials was bound to rise. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Now, the odds against a lottery win are so astronomically steep that many of us prefer to save that lucky note or coin for another purpose. But that doesn't deter hundreds of millions of people around the world from picking their numbers and hoping that fortune will fall into their laps and change their lives overnight. But the concepts of rollovers, Euro Millions, or even the Spanish El Gordo are all too ostentatious for the Ethiopian Lottery Administration, who run perhaps the tightest and most austere lottery in the world, and have been doing so for over 50 years. To discover more about how it's run, our correspondent Joaquin Bessing joined us on the line from Addis Ababa just before we came on air, and started by explaining a little of the history behind the Ethiopian National Lottery.
The official name is the National Lottery Administration. It's run by the government, and the date of the founding is in 1954. So in 2004, they had their big 50 years jubilee, and the building, I'm standing right next because my hotel is neighboring the building, is quite huge. It's one of the hugest buildings in Addis Ababa. And on top of it, there's still the symbol, which is very charming, goes back to the 50s, I suppose. It's a white chicken that bears a kind of a big jar, and this jar is filled with money. So it's sticking out on top of the jar, and it's the green 100 birr note that dates back to that time too.
Okay, is there any significance to the existence of the chicken?
No, I think it's just a lucky chicken. Or maybe it's a lucky goose. You cannot see, it's just handmade, the symbol. It's hard to be, I would call it a chicken, but maybe it's a goose. I think it's a lucky animal. It's just like, drags around this jar full of money. And the machines inside, I've never seen such machines in my life before. They are made of stainless steel. They're quite huge. They are, you have to envision them as a kind of a ball-shaped cage on a kind of a tripod. And they are man size. And there are six of them. They are starting from the hundreds and goes to the thousands and the ten thousands. And there are several meant for lucky numbers. So basically, it happens inside. It's a huge room, and there's an orange-painted stage that resembles a bit like Barbarella, and there are this like shiny machines. And then, as soon as the procedure starts, there are guys in light blue lab coats. They step up to the machines, and they're assisting girls. And as soon as one ball falls into access the machine, and the lucky number is drawn by this, one of the girls standing near to the assisting guy will lift up a cardboard plate with the number painted on it so that everybody can see it, because you have to take in consideration it's a huge entertainment thing to watch it on television, the drawing of the lottery numbers, and as well, the room, which I told you before, holds up to, I think, 300 persons, and they are brought to the weekly draw in buses, so it's in front of a big audience, this spectacle.
As far as you know, where did they get these lottery machines from?
They are left here by the Italians. The Italians were the only, like, a colonial force. They're halfway made up from the north up to Addis Ababa. And they left basically three good things here. And they only lasted for 4 years, and then they were defeated and dragged out of the country decided to go elsewhere. So they left their espresso machines, where you can get a decent espresso everywhere in Addis Ababa. And, of course, they have here the best beans because coffee was found first in Ethiopia. Secondly, these are the lotto drawing machines. They are Italian-made. And I think that the Italians started the lottery and then just left the machines, and the Ethiopians took over. And the third thing they left here is very, very tasteful pasta and pizza, which you can get in every Ethiopian restaurant, which is nice distraction from the usual injera you get here every day, which is kind of a spongy flatbread that you talk indeed.
Well, it sounds lovely. And by the sound of it, all sounds very low tech, but it all sounds very serious. And how seriously do they take the drawing of these numbers?
I was astonished that it's taken very seriously, because you have to take in consideration the weekly draw emits a sum of 240,000 birr, which makes roughly about £8,000. And this is a massive sum, considering the state the country's in. So the lucky winner is really well off. So everybody's very concentrated on the drawing process. There's a long table, and there sit like five or six judges, because the drawing of the issuing of the tickets is by hawkers in the street. But there is an introduction of scanning technology for scanning the numbers, but the processing of the numbers from the many, many villages outside of Addis Ababa is still done by hand. So I had the chance to talk to the president of the lottery administration. He's a charming, very, very nice, suave talking gentleman who's living in a kind of a light blue painted hut, and he has masses, really, like, you have to believe, stacks of paper that are covered with numbers, and they are the basis for the drawing system. So these five judges sitting there, and as soon as a full number for the first prize or second prize or third prize is drawn, they are going through all the lists and trying to find the one who is won by the numbers they have on these massive piles of papers. It's really not low-tech, it's really very manual.
And was there any, just finally, Joachim, was there any indication that there had been any foul play, that people had been falsifying their tickets, maybe?
No, that is not possibly going to happen, because the process in the shooting of the machines and the balls is so, it takes like, everything takes long over here. The process of checking of the balls and the numbers, the presenting of the balls and the numbers, the double checking of the balls and the numbers and the machines and the judge takes about half of the ritual, will be like an hour. The full draw of the three lucky numbers was taking about nearly 2 hours. It's a very slow, a very ceremonial ritual. I've never seen something like this before when it comes to lottery.
That was Joachim Bessing talking to us from Addis Ababa on the meticulous operation of the Ethiopian National Lottery. Coming up on Midori House, the truth about statistics, how percentages change policies that affect our lives.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
Forty minutes past the hour, still to come, our edits editor Santiago Tarditi comes into the studio. But first, we're going to have a little bit of music. This is Crave You by Flight Facilities featuring Giselle.
Why can you want me like the other boys do? They stare at me while I stare at you. Why can't I keep you safe as my own? One moment I have you, the next you.
Crave You by Flight Facilities featuring Giselle there. 44 minutes past the hour. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24 e yokoso.
This is Monocle 24.
Tama on Monocle coxigumata neria.
The Bropa Jalabat. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
It's midnight 45 in Bangkok, 18:45 here in London. Now, Mark Twain might have popularised Benjamin Disraeli's assertion, that there are lies, damn lies, and then statistics. But what can facts and figures about what the world is doing tell us about what's going on in our lives right now? Well, a little earlier today, Chloe Potter asked Ben Page, who analyses facts as a living as CEO of Ipsos Mori Research Group, this very question, and asked how statistics are actually created.
Every month around the world in 24 different countries, we ask thousands and thousands of consumers how they're feeling about the way the economy is going. And I think I'm just becoming a bit, I mean, the Olympics is now over. I do want to talk about them in a second because there's some good news there. But overall, for the world as a whole, it's a horrid reminder that we haven't had a V-shaped recovery or a W-shaped recovery or a bath-shaped recovery. We're having an L-shaped recession. And at the moment, only 37% of people in the world reckon that their local economy is good. And the problem is that, you know, that's an average for the world. The difficulty is that the countries that were seeing a lot of growth and were optimistic are now also starting to become pessimistic, like the Brits and the Europeans.
And the problem with this, Ben, is that confidence in the economy is so key to a successful economy, isn't it?
That's right. And what we've actually found is that, you know, in my job, of course, I have to believe in the wisdom of crowds. And we found that there's actually a reasonably good correlation between the direction of travel in consumer opinion and what actually happens in economies 12 months later. So when we ask people in Britain, for example, do you think the economy will get better or worse in the next 12 months? there's actually a reasonably good fit between what they say is likely to happen and what actually happens. Because, of course, they don't go and buy a new car or a house or a splash out on a new kitchen if they're feeling, you know, worried about the future.
And, of course, they then read about how everyone else is feeling doubtful and it spirals.
But the real issue is that the growth parts of the world, I mean, many big companies, including my own, have been growing in recent years despite the overall turmoil in the West because, of course, Asia, Africa, Latin America, etc., have been booming. But what the evidence is now coming through in public opinion in those countries, as that we've seen in their as with some of the economic numbers, that's now dropping down. So if you take India, for example, 79% of the people there back in March were positive about their economy. That's fallen to 58%. It's a 21-point drop. China down from 71 to 60. And when China catches a cold, there is a problem. So this is, if this trend continues, we have real issues, and you don't want to be in Argentina.
Oh, really?
No, down from 55 to in January to who were positive to only 34%.
Oh dear.
A lot of these markets that were seeing strong growth, they aren't seeing it now, and that's a problem because they're the people supplying, selling stuff, buying stuff, etc.
Absolutely, Ben. Turning to some more positive news, you've been looking at the impact of the Olympics, haven't you? And it does seem that they've left a really lovely positive glow behind them.
Yes, and I think that's interesting. I mean, you know, the British, of course, gloomy, pessimistic, you know, grumbling, etc., but somehow have been persuaded to cheer up. I was vaguely sceptical. A pretty wonderful Olympics, I think. So overall, 74% of people in Britain think that it's made them feel better about London, the BBC, the royal family, the mayor of London, Boris Johnson, our transport system. I mean, gosh, I mean, what's happening to us? And interestingly, 4 out of 10 of them said it made them feel better about the NHS. Now, as far as I know, the NHS hasn't treated any more people. But of course, Danny Boyle's wonderful opening ceremony had loads of nurses dancing around beds. I wonder what people around the world made of that. But of course, the NHS does have the health service in Britain does have a key part in British society and in many people's ideas about the country.
Absolutely. And the opening ceremony, perhaps just reminding people what they should feel proud about in terms of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is part of, like the BBC, like the monarchy. And I mean, I was amazed at the number of emails I got from my friends around the world when they started to see the Queen actually in a movie with James Bond. But, you know, I think importantly, particularly given the state of the economy, most people, by a margin of at least 3 or even 4 to 1, believe it will benefit both London and the UK economy as a whole. So they're very positive about it, and they do give, you know, respect to obviously the GAF leagues, Sebastian Coe, the one of the lead organisers, but also interestingly the volunteers. And one of the things about London, again, you know, you say gloomy Londoners never want to talk to anybody, won't look at each other on the tube. 6 out of 10 people in Britain say actually it was the volunteers themselves that made it a great Olympics.
That was Ben Page, CEO of research group Ipsos Mori, talking to Chloe Potter a little earlier today. You're listening to Midori House. Still to come, Santiago Tarditi with some of the best stories in the September issue of Monocle magazine.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. As a Monocle 24.
Welcome to Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπρούσελ, Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, στο Κασίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
London, Ball, as a Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπρούσελ, Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, είναι Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que que Nina teve no ar? Monocle 24.
Afto é no Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24-tagat, ja.
51 minutes past the hour. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, each day this week, in celebration of the glorious new September issue of Monocle magazine, which is on your newsstands or popping through your letterboxes around the world this week, we've been looking at different sections of the magazine. Today, it's the edit section, you know, the one with the E on it towards the back. And I'm joined in the studio by our acting edits editor, Santiago Tarditi. Hi, Santiago.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, very well, thank you very much. Now, everybody will have noticed from the soldier on the front through to the great article about the USS George Washington. There's a military theme to Monocle magazine this month. And what did you find about the Switzerland and the people who keep an army's stomachs full?
Yeah, exactly. It was a bit of a challenge because, of course, it's not very easy to relate good cooking to the military. But our writer and radio producer, Hannah Jenkins, got in touch with Rito Walter. He's part of the Swiss Army's chef team that showed us around their facilities and taught us how to cook a couple of their staple dishes. Hannah went to a town called Thun. This is a town known for great food, and it's also home to the largest army base in the country. And if you look at the pages, she tried the army beef stew and my favorite, the Swiss army cheese crouton.
Now, that's a crouton.
How good does that look?
It does look fantastic.
It's amazing.
Well, the pot-au-feu looks pretty good as well. We'll get on to recipe one in a moment. But that's what I love about this section, actually, is that you managed to get the whole recipe in 240 grams of cheese mix, which is 60 grams each, by the way, of Emmental, Grazia, Tillister and Appenzeller. But it's not just the crouton, although the crouton does make a pretty big bit of it. And it's a picture alongside it of two guys enjoying this said crouton. It looks like you should just dip it in a soup somewhere, but actually the soup isn't included.
The soup is not included, no. The beef stew is, but I guess that the reason why they're happy is because this food is very fresh. Every morning, the team at the Swiss Army calls in a lot of supplies from local growers and producers. This is not your typical military food that comes in tins or cans. Of course, it's not something you will find in survival packs. This is really fresh food, hearty recipes, and they're treated very well because for every 50 soldiers, there is a chef guaranteeing that this food is going to be up to the highest standards that the army has.
Well, not only that, but also using some of the best ingredients and suppliers that Switzerland has to offer, including, intriguingly, the chocolatiers.
Yeah, yeah. What's funny is that the Swiss Army have their own chocolate, their own biscuits. They even have their own kitchen trailer. And what's more interesting is that they have their own cookbook, which apparently is very popular around the country. Every soldier goes back home with a copy of it.
Yeah, well, it's particularly intriguing and interesting, given that Switzerland has always been a neutral country, although it does keep an army for its own sort of self-defense as well. It doesn't tend to get involved very often. But there's also been a clip, actually, that the aforementioned Hannah Jenkins has been making. It's also available, as Gillian de Vice's film on Marseille was a little earlier, on monocle.com, and we can hear a clip from it now. We can't hear a clip from it now, but we'll hear a clip from it in just a minute. Something else I was intrigued about in the edits section was some. There's the usual restaurants as well, but what else did you pick out of there? Not too much. Some very nice hotels, as usual, towards the front of it. Especially, where are we? In Hong Kong.
Yeah, that's a very nice hotel. It's called the Tay O Heritage Hotel. We sent one of our writers who's based in Hong Kong to check it out. It's a new project where a couple of entrepreneurs with the help of the local government took over a derelict police station and revamped it, converted it into this very, very nice and slick hotel. I particularly enjoyed doing the My Last Meal interview, where I went and interviewed Vaughn Smith, the founder of the Frontline Club here in London, a club dedicated to protect, to
foreign
help,
correspondents.
And yeah, the foreign correspondents and the journalists in general. There's also a recipe there for the frontline fish cakes, which are his favorites, and he would include in his last meal.
Okay, well, talking of recipes, we've now located this clip from the meat of the battle, Switzerland's armed forces and the people who cater for them. Here it is.
In the Swiss town of Thun, there's a place that is known for its fresh, locally sourced and organic cuisine. Here, meals are served with the precision the country is known for, and the emphasis is on health, fitness, and nutrition. It's not a hip new restaurant, but the core tenets of the Swiss military's philosophy on food in the core.
Swiss Army there in training, and that film, along with many others, of course, available on monocle.com. So, Santiago, just a minute left. What else is taking your eye in the edit section? I'm quite intrigued by the military must-haves. You wouldn't have thought that anybody in sort of camouflage gear is particularly cool, but some of this stuff is fairly interesting. Some interesting lighters, amongst other stuff.
Well, yeah, we selected these supplies because they're not only for the soldiers to use, but you can actually use some of the things we feature him here. Like, for example, the goggles are perfect for skiing. Mm. The Zippo hand warmers. The handcuffs, but I don't know if we can use that. But definitely the water pack would be good for running around town.
Brilliant. Okay, Santiago Tarditi, thank you very much. Well, that's all from this edition of Midori House. The producer today was Hannah Jenkins, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Stay tuned, because up next after the news is this week's brand new episode of The Menu, where today we'll be getting tips on how to make the best coffee from Berlin's brand new Coffee Academy. I'll be back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily tonight, but from all of us here at Midori House, for now, it's goodbye.